on a personal level, Davis gave me a ton of advice.
Oh, wow.
Around 2012, when Taylor and I went to, well, it wasn't his first Olympics, it was my first Olympics, but we were there for the road, and Davis was in the car with me every day on the training rides and things like that. And he and I had a lot of discussions about raising a child as a pro athlete and the pitfalls that come with that. And Davis is, as you can imagine, is incredibly knowledgeable. And then you have Connie, also incredibly knowledgeable from the business side, not only, and the athlete side. So I'm sure, you know, Taylor was not hurting for advice. And I'm sure it was a family decision, because everything in the Finneys is a family decision.
Welcome again to the Between Two Wheels podcast. In studio, we're flashing the same colors here today. Mike Sayers, nice. Welcome back. You know, you're their number one download. I think that was the first time you came in. It's our biggest download online, so welcome. Maybe we'll boost a third one here.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, you know me, man. I'm a NorCal honk, so right. Anything NorCal is good for me.
Right, and I appreciate, you know, I get comments too. I'm out riding, and people are like, you know, that interview with Mike, I just loved it. So I appreciate it. And I had a great time. So
yeah, these are great conversations for me too.
Yeah.
And I appreciate, having done a little bit of this on the side, I appreciate, this is really a difficult endeavor for those people who enjoy the right. podcast. I just want to let you know, it's not an easy endeavor.
Right.
So yeah.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about that. 'Cause I know before you were doing something with, Dave Toll.
Yeah.
And have you done anything? Are you looking to do something yourself? I want to promote as much as possible here. So,
yeah. So I don't like to bring in my own agenda, but I have been toying with
you,
this.
You are welcome to agenda out here. You know, we'll pay out later.
So. Okay. Yeah. So I've started this little kind of side gig, interview. I call it a non-podcast podcast. It's basically an interview with, I'm going to start really local. So it's called Interviews from the Grubetto. And I just post it on my social media. So about every 2 weeks or something, I put something out. But I really only have done one. And the first one I did was with Judy Polkov, who used to own City Bicycle Works. And so for those of us who grew up in Sacramento, City, when it was a quote unquote family owned shop, was really important to the community. And I think Judy as a person, for those who don't know Judy, she is an amazing person, just as a person. And she was one of my coaching clients, and we became really, really good friends. And I kick myself for not being friends with her in the past. And, you know, I think for those of us who are customers of City, maybe off and on, we always dealt with Jess.
Yeah.
And Jess was a big personality in Sacramento. But I think Judy is one of those people that's like the woman behind the man. And I hope everybody got a little insight of what it is to own a bike shop, number one, because I can, as a small business owner, I can tell you it's really difficult. And Judy as a person is an incredible person. And I think she brings a lot to the cycling community because she still rides a lot. She's really passionate about the sport at every level, whether it's racing or just riding. And she's juggling a lot. You know, her and Jess are no longer together, which is what it is. But, and the shop has now been sold to Trek, and it's a corporate store. So that is what it is. And they're trying to rebrand it a little bit, I think. But for me personally, when I got into cycling, City was a huge part of, it was a big focus for me. It was like my hub. And when I opened my now old business, Die, I tried to make it into like a hub. That was one of my inspirations. So she was kind of an inspiration to me. So these are the kind of interviews that I want to give, are just really intimate, like local people that we all know, that you know, that I know, that your fans know, and just maybe, you know, just have like an intimate friends conversation.
Well, I'll put a link to it then, because I saw you had posted something, but I hadn't checked it out yet.
Okay.
I'm a busy man.
Right. No. So, and I don't want to, I'm not here to step on anybody's toes. And I really want
to. It's a big world for podcasts.
Right,
trust me.
Right. And I want everybody to enjoy it. I really am doing it because I love this avenue, this venue.
Yeah.
And I love what you've created, and you've done, I mean, really, you're kind of a role model for me. I'm not going to lie.
Nah, well,
you know, I mean, what this podcast does for racing and for the issues that face people who race their bikes or ride their bikes a lot or do group rides here in town, it's really an important thing. So I just wanted to give like a different avenue, and I'm doing it kind of for fun right now. And it's because I have a little more time on my hands, and it gives me an opportunity to work on giving back to the community, which I'm becoming more and more about. I've always been about, but now it's more and more important to me.
Yeah, and that's good. Look, I'll give you any advice you want. I'm sure you don't need it, but like I said, I'll put a link to it. I think those interviews, you know, I love doing the commentary, and you know, again, we're going to talk about that. But even this, just getting down and sitting, you know, world is different. Like when podcasting, you know, these long form interviews, it's a chance to just kind of riff and get a lot more out, and it's enjoyable for me.
Yeah, so. and podcasts have been become a huge part of my just everyday life.
Yeah.
I mean. I have certain, like everybody, I have shows that I listen to or watch or whatever, but I'm an audio learner that was in school. I was an audio learner. And for me, listening to a books on tape or listening to a podcast, no matter what it is the way that I kind of learn or maybe learn's a heavy word, but like educate myself or open my mind or whatever.
I hope it's not learned because my wife is stuck on crime once. And if she learns crime... It's gonna be rough.
Well, you're a lawyer, so you're
well, good. But it's gonna be murder on me. That's what it'll be. Okay, let's get into the cycling stuff.
Okay,
so first thing, I just wanted to hit a few little topics real quick, and then we'll talk about the whole season too. Obviously, the big thing that came out was the Tour of California, setting the hiatus. And I know you've been talked to with media and stuff, but did you see this coming? And what was your first reaction when you heard the news?
So as I like everything in the world, hindsight is 2020. Yeah. There were a few key things that happened in the run in to the announcement. And as I look back on it, I was like, oh, yeah, obvious. For me, the number one cue, and I remember I said this to my wife when I read it, was Peter Sagan committing to the Giro.
Yeah, yeah.
When I saw that, in the back of my mind, I was like, wow, that's really a big step in a different direction for him. Which is not necessarily unusual, but he's become almost synonymous with the Tour of California in so many ways. And he does, you know, he does Grand Fondos here now, and he does all kinds of stuff in California. I mean, he'll probably end up here someday full time. And so when he had committed to the Giro, I was like, wow, that's really, really interesting.
Does AEG or the organizers, do they put out feelers to the riders? I mean, you think there was any communication with him that he had foreknowledge of this?
I have no way of knowing. My guess would be that he actually was intimately knowledgeable about what was going to happen, which is why he probably committed to the Giro. Gotcha. If the team knew the race was going to go on a hiatus for the year, then I think his team was able to quote unquote leverage that with the Giro. And, you know, maybe they got something out of it. It's hard to say, but I'm almost for sure, because he was such a big part of the race, that AEG would have done their due diligence with him and let him know that the race was not going to happen. Because quite frankly, for a race that size at that time of year, it's the deadline, the deadline, because everybody is getting, all the teams are getting invitations. And I know this because as I'm working with the national team again, and I'm sending out invitation requests, battling for those spots in some of these European races in the month of March and April. And I'm like right on the limit. Like I really should have been doing this like 3 weeks ago, but now I'm into it. So yeah. So I understand how that works.
So you're the USA Cycling. We talked about this last time you're in here that you got the special invite. Well, not special invite. You had a loophole that you had never taken advantage of, got into the race. You guys blew it up. I mean, first day, everything. It was phenomenal to watch. How does this kind of, I imagine your goals were to let's increase and improve on what we did in 2019 to 2020. How does this kind of put that USA team in flux on any of this? Or is this just, since you're pulling from multiple teams, does it really affect it? Or did you have different plans for the...
No. The Tour of California was a big deal for us. And I'm really, really disappointed on a personal level. Sure. And as
hometown,
hometown. And just from the national team side of it, I'm really disappointed because all of the goals that we had for Tour of California, and let me say that none of those goals had to do with results. Hmm. It was just... the presence of the national team, building on the Team USA, giving people to, as we enter an Olympic year, and giving some riders opportunities to further their career, whether they were under 23 riders or, as you know, we had a couple of elite guys.
Yeah.
Those were all the goals of the national team going to the Tour of California, and we literally accomplished every single goal. And the example, my primary example, would be that Travis McCabe, at this point, seems to be able to have turned that his results there into a bigger contract of the bigger team. It hasn't been announced, so I'm not going to be the one to announce it, but it looks like it was working out the way
Floyd's
we
is closing. I mean, what yeah. I've heard that Floyd's is they needed more Armstrong money, maybe yeah. Bernil money is what they're looking for now. But
yeah, the team is stopping, and I think Travis had been, and he was well in on his way to getting a World Tour deal, and so like I said, it's not my place to announce sure. it, but it looks like he was able to do that, and for sure, those Tour of California results led or were a building block in that happening.
Sure. And that's actually great news. You know, I've been a little worried on him. You know, he's getting older. He had the results, USA Nationals, you know, a few years ago behind his teammate. And then he's just kind of knocking, but not quite getting there. So right. It's good to hear.
Yeah. So as on a personal level, the Tour of California not happening is really, really tough. Because we had plans and we were going to be there and it was all in the works. What it means to the national team is, I mean, it's not the end of the world. Yeah, it doesn't mean the program stops. It means we put our focus in a little different area. It opens our budget up a little bit, clearly, and we can do some other races. There is the race in Baltimore at the end of the year, which is the new one-day race right before the Canadian World Cups. Yeah, yeah. So we may at this point look like we possibly might try to take a run at that and bring a team to that. It's only a 1 day race, so it's not the same level. But you know, we want to try to. Jeff Pierce, who's the new head of athletics at USA Cycling, is very focused on trying to have some kind of presence here in America as a national team. And there aren't a lot of opportunities to do it, but there are some opportunities to do it, and we're going to try to do it. And you know, right now it looks like Baltimore's a perfect example. Now, we haven't even spoken to them, so I have no idea what's going to happen. But we have some riders out there, with really interesting riders that are now on World Tour teams that maybe their World Tour teams are not going to be able to make the Baltimore race. And so it might open us up to some more elite riders. We'll be a couple of six-ish weeks off the Olympics, so there'll be some hype from that. And yeah, so as the national team goes, it was a big plan of ours. We have a little hole in the calendar. We're trying to remedy that situation.
Okay, and I want to talk about Olympic trials and kind of how that whole thing goes. Mm-hmm. But what do you think about just the state of, you know, now we don't have any, well, I shouldn't say we don't have any big tours. Tour Utah seems to be like the only one left. Yeah. And looking at that over the last few years, you know, last year you had EF Education First, you know, top priority team, and then Israel Cycling Academy, who's moved up now. But last year they weren't on the World Tour 20 teams, I believe.
Right.
So, and you look at that over the last few years, it's just been kind of dwindling down. What do we have? USA Crits?
Yeah, it's tough.
I mean,
it's tough right now.
I know we can't always have a big tour, but it's nice.
Oh, it is nice.
And I'm thinking now of teams like, you know, Rally UHC. That might have been their biggest event of the year.
Yeah.
The Tour of California, much like, you know, the USA Cycling, of course, but kind of puts it in flux. What is there to take that feel for these teams now? Is it, I mean, it's got to be abroad, right?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. I mean, it's hard to make a comment on where the state of US cycling is going. A lot of these teams are like Rally and, you know, Axel's team, Action. There, a lot of teams are focusing on going to Europe for a lot of the year, and there are still some really nice races in America. There's Arkansas. Redlands is always Redlands is always a mainstay. Gila is always a mainstay. You know, and we have a few other things going, but yeah, we need to bolster the calendar a little bit, and we're just in a down phase right now. But the flip side of that coin, or the other side of the cube, or whatever, however you want to put it, is that our rider depth is really improving. Mm-hmm. And we have junior world champions, both men and women. We have the Olympics is right around the corner, so the track programs are fully heated up. The women's truck program is absolutely smashing it. And I don't even think they're going as good as they could go right now. Gary Sutton, who's in charge of the track program, he's got a great plan. They got really good athletes in there. So there's, from an athlete standpoint, we're doing great. And we just need a few more domestic events to help the teams out. And hopefully in the next couple of years that we'll get some more domestic events back. But then again, the other side of the cube is that we have these other events like gravel events and, you know, mountain bike stage races and endurance events that are opening the door for other types of riding, which I think being diversified is super important. Right, so right. We'll see what happens.
Okay. We're all over the board here. Peter Stetna decides to step away. From what I could read, it looked like he at least probably was getting some offer somewhere, but he decided on his own. So I'm speculating. I don't feel that he was forced out, just reading into the under the line. What do you think about what he's doing? And then compare that with Taylor Finney, who just decided I'm done and over. I'm completely walking out of this. Kind of the two of those and where that puts American cycling, because it looks like to me either there was a lack of enjoyment on both sides or just wanting something completely different. I don't know.
Well, I think I think the sport of cycling, like every sport in the world right now, is getting younger, right? So, yeah. I mean, the facts are if you're a 30-year-old World Tour professional right now, I would be a little nervous because you have kids coming right out of juniors now going World Tour or going Pro Continental. Right. You have very young ladies that are performing at a really, really high level, like dominating on the world scene, on the track, on the mountain bike, you know, cyclocross. So I think the sport is getting younger. In our era, like in the era that you and I raced in, it was not uncommon for guys to race deep into their 30s. When I retired, I was 39. Our last world champion prior to this year was Valverde, who was 38. My gut tells me that's probably the last 38-year-old world champion that we'll see at the elite level for quite a while.
Yeah, I could see that.
And so what ends up happening is instead of guys retiring at 35 and moving on to their next thing, I think there's going to be a lot more riders you're going to see that are going to retire between 26 and 30, and they're going to move on to their next thing, whatever that is. And the great part of that is that some of those younger people at 50, some of those younger people have educations and they're able to flex that muscle, which I think is great.
Yeah.
And I also think at some point so I coach a few athletes that are transitioning into the pro ranks next year. And the number one thing I try to express to them is that it's when you're an amateur and you're going to amateur races, local races, or you're doing one or two stage races a year, it's all good, right? You're plenty rested and you can plan for everything and it's no problem. Then you cross that threshold where you're traveling every single weekend, you're going to the East Coast multiple times a year, you're going to Europe. All of a sudden, the time management becomes a huge issue. All right. And I think at some point, men and women just get tired of time management issues and they want to stay at home more. They have a family or they want to have a family in the case of some of the female riders. And so they're going to stop racing and they're going to move on to the next thing, which is fine.
You know, you talked about transitioning out. This happened with Bob Roll, a few of these where they're done in the road and they turn to mountain biking because mountain biking was a big deal back then.
Right.
You could start making your money. You didn't have to have a team.
Yep.
I just see this with gravel. I mean, that's Stetna. Stetna is kind of doing what Talansky, I guess, in a sense is doing, you know, just getting my own sponsors and I'm going to go be my solo rider. Who knows what's going to happen.
That's kind of like running a small business.
Yeah.
So that can be really rewarding on one side because you're managing yourself, you're managing your sponsors, you have the relationships, so you can kind of dictate how it goes. Clearly, it can be really stressful because it could all come crashing to an end like overnight. But I mean, they're using the skills that they learned in being a professional cyclist, and they're just expanding their knowledge. I mean, there's been plenty of other riders that have done other things, like Ted King.
Yeah,
he had his own business with the Maple business, and then there's been other guys that have expanded out and had their own businesses. Maybe they started out as a side gig, and then they ended up being something else, or their full time gig. So I think it just leads to a much more diversified Peloton. And I think for a guy like Pete, he's not a kid anymore, right? Which is crazy. You think about it. I remember when he was an under. Yeah. I remember when he was a first year senior. And it's like, man, he's not a kid anymore. He's got a family, you know, and he's just going to make his own way. And the same for Talansky. I saw Andrew a couple of weeks ago at the Levi Grand Fondo, and he seems like really happy. And ultimately, that's what you want everybody to be. Right, you want them to be happy and in a good mental state. And racing is not easy. It's really not. I mean, mentally, it can just be crushing.
So, and I totally agree. And then as I'm talking about this a few weeks ago, it kind of hits me that we all have, like, my job isn't necessarily easy either. Yeah. Now, granted, I could get to go home and see my family, and that's a much different aspect. And I'm sure that's maybe the linchpin of this whole problem, you know, being away and just being kind of out in the middle of nowhere. But, you know, does it ever give you pause of, like, you raced late in your career and you see someone like Taylor Finney with this massive amount of potential and talent, and he just decides to walk away? I mean, that's obviously his own doing, but, you know, there's people out there that are like, I would give my left leg and more to do this, but then they're not in that situation.
Right. So. They're not. And I think you have to walk in their shoes, or at least, well, you just, not even that, you just respect their decision.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Taylor comes from a long line of athletes in his family, clearly.
Yeah.
Every member of his family is like a world-class athlete. His sister is a world-class cross-country skier. So it's like, there's no lack of performance in the family.
Right.
And so, he and his mom and his dad, and I think maybe I mentioned this before, like Davis, on a personal level, Davis gave me a ton of advice.
Oh, wow.
Around 2012 when Taylor and I went to, well, it wasn't his first Olympics, it was my first Olympics, but we were there for the road, and Davis was in the car with me every day on the training rides and things like that. And he and I had a lot of discussions about raising a child as a pro athlete and the pitfalls that come with that. And Davis is, as you can imagine, is incredibly knowledgeable. And then you have Connie, also incredibly knowledgeable from the business side, not only, and the athlete side. So I'm sure, you know, Taylor was not hurting for advice. And I'm sure it was a family decision, because everything in the Finneys is a family decision. And they just decided to go a different direction. And you know, of course, I can look at Taylor because I worked with him on so many levels over multiple years. And yeah, I mean, man, he was an unbelievable athletic talent. At the same time, he had a lot of different interests and he just decided to switch his priorities. And so, you know, he was a big personality. He was what cycling needed. And now we need to find other personalities to fill that role.
Let's talk about some of those new personalities. I mean, USA Cycling at Worlds this year, but for the pro men, and nothing against them, I mean, just everything. We're juniors, men, juniors, women, you know, U23, men and women, Chloe Dygert it was just a phenomenal time. And you were there, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you give me first of all, which team were you working with specifically? Are we working with a broad spectrum? And then kind of give us your breakdown of what you felt at Worlds and the most exciting aspect besides Quinn Simmons.
So I take the under 23 men and the elite men, and we kind of put those two things together. This year it was a little hard in Yorkshire because the way that the UCI set up the courses was that all of the starts were like in a different place.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
So it was really difficult to manage the team aspect of it, you know, training rides and things like that. But the athletes are really good and they understand. And in this day and age, what I find totally amazing is that with all the technology, the Garmins and the this and the that, like, I don't need to draw maps with these guys anymore. They figure it out on their own, right? Yeah. So we just do the daily schedule, make sure they're organized, have what they need. So from the whole U.S. team, even the teams that didn't necessarily win any medals, what I can say was the vibe within the team was one of the best, most positive vibes that I've ever had. And it very clearly started with the juniors setting the bar very, very high. And, you know, I think we all went in. There was a lot of work that went in pre-race, course recons, you know, like a lot of discussion about how the courses were going to run, who the riders were going to be. And at the end of the day, what I can say is that every single group of athletes, so junior men, junior women, you know, under 23 men and women, elite men. We had goals, or USA Cycling had goals for every single group. And the truth is that every single group either met or exceeded the goals that were laid out for them. And so what I can get, so we know the winners, right? We know the junior men, right, and the junior women on the roadside winning clearly exceeded goals.
Yeah.
But on the under 23 side, the two men, Ian and McNulty, they exceeded their expectations, or at least fulfilled their expectations in the TT, because if you look at historically where they've been in that position.
Right, right.
Those three riders that were on the podium have been in some configuration of that for like the last 3 years. And then on the elite men side, the number one goal we had coming in was we needed a time trial rider in the top 10 to ensure that we would get a second time trial rider at the Olympics.
Yeah.
And Lawson more than upheld his side of the bargain.
Yeah.
And he came in, he was very, I mean, everybody knows, they watched him at the Vuelta. He was very prepared. He came in. Chad Haga was also very prepared. He, I mean, again, Chad, what's interesting about Chad is he now is at 32. This goes back to what we were just talking about. At 32, I believe Chad is the oldest member of Wow. Sunweb. I someone's going to probably double check me, but I think he might be the oldest member of Sunweb, which is totally nuts when you think about it.
Right.
And he had a huge year, double Grand Tour. Yeah. You know, I mean, Chad has been flying under the radar a little bit for the Americans for a while. He's a TT specialist. He won the last stage of the Giro. And I don't see his progression changing at all. And in fact, for him, it might get a little more interesting because now they don't have their team is going really, really young with the loss of Dumoulin. So he may have a little more freedom going forward. But between him and Lawson, I mean, they knew what the objective was, to have at least one rider in the top 10. We put a ton of work into it, a lot of video, a lot of recon. And I will tell you that every single one of those courses in Yorkshire were some of the most difficult, especially the time trial, were some of the most difficult courses I've ever seen at any level. I'm very technical. A lot of work needed to go in that for pre-ride to understand how to get a result out of that.
Just looking at the, sorry, and you go back to this, looking at some of the courses, I mean, they were all different for the different categories.
Right.
And it looked like some of the junior U23, it seemed like the further they went down, the more corners or through town they just from looking at the profile, am I wrong, was it just really snaky through towns and
corners? it was incredibly technical. Okay. Incredibly technical. And just the just the time trial sheet and the video that we did from my side, I mean, I'm not gonna, I take zero credit for those guys' results, but at the end of the day, the work, I've never had to put so much work in, especially for the time trials from the recon side. I think I drove the men's elite time trial course a dozen times in like 5 days.
Oh, geez.
And I mean, it wasn't easy. It was like an hour to get out there and then, you know, an hour and a half back. And then I think the weight for me, the most, I mean, I still get nervous for these guys because number one, because I care, but number two, I know how stressful it can be. And with the weather was another whole, this whole other thing with the weather. But when Lawson and those guys went, I was so stressed because it was just, I knew what was ahead of them. I mean, we're looking at it. It's like an hour and 15 minutes of time trialing at the highest level, not a local level, but like at the highest level. The stress on those guys had to just be unbelievable. And they did their homework and we tried our best to do our homework. And I think at the end, we accomplished our goals. I mean, I think we really did. And I think you can see, like, from, you know, there was a lot of talk about Chloe going in, being a track rider, not being able to handle. I mean, listen, she set the world on fire.
Yeah,
she smoked it. Yeah, she took a gas can out there and threw a bunch of gas on it and put a blowtorch to it.
Right.
I mean, it was unbelievable. And then when you see her, so the run-in on the time trial for the women and the under 23 men, the first 18K were the same. And when she went through that, I don't remember what checkpoint it was, the first checkpoint on the flat road. And when she went through the first checkpoint, she was ahead of both our under 23 men which tells you all you need to know about like where her talent stands. And so for her, like there is no ceiling. And I think that there's other women out there that are coming, there is no ceiling. And I think for the under 23 men, they're both on world tour teams now. They're both ready to go. And we're going to see what's going to happen. And I, you know, we were having this discussion not too long ago about what we're going to do at the Olympics. And we have some, or the upper executives at USA Cycling have some decisions to make. You know, do we focus just on the time trial for the men? Do we take one man for the time trial, one man for the road race because we only get two? But there's some decisions to make, and I think that the level of, we've always been good in the time trial. If you historically you look, Bobby Julik, Lance, Frank Andreo, George, those guys are all good TT guys. Some of the best in the world at the time. Levi. We have another crop that's coming for sure. And so there's a real chance that we could garner some medals going forward or just solid results, both in Grand Tours at the local level and at the Olympics. What was really interesting is I had to go through just the other day, I had to go through and kind of chart some of the results we had last year at the elite and the under 23 level in the men's. And what was shockingly interesting to me and put a big smile on my face is if you look at all the results that we garnered as a country last year across all of our riders, we as a country actually had a really good year. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of guys who got a lot of top threes and a lot of stages, especially in the time trial. We had some under 23s that won some really, well, we'll call them high profile under 23 events, European, you know, 2.2s, 2.1s. Okay. So we actually had an incredible year as a nation last year, both on the men's and the women's side. The women, they can speak for themselves. Yeah. But we had really good year. So really, right now, we're actually looking pretty good. The issue is that for some of these races, there's not a lot of media coverage, and maybe we need to help bump that up a little bit. But ultimately, the riders are upholding their end of the bargain as we see it right now. And we have some really good riders coming, and we just need to work really hard to try to help some of these younger guys transition to the elite ranks and continue that level of success and then improve upon it.
I just want to talk about a few things specific. I watched the whole entire junior race, and it was interesting to watch that. I didn't watch it live. I watched it, so I already knew the results, which was even more interesting because the announcers, they kept talking about you know, the USA team, they're, you know, Quinn Simmons, this is the team. They are expecting to win, and they rode like it. I mean, they put the hurt on everybody and then attacked when they were putting the hurt on him. It was amazing. It was impressive. You said they made their expectations. I mean, that was by, I don't know if you guys expected all four of them in the top 20.
Well, I think Billy Innes is in charge of that program. Billy's from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And Billy had been with those guys. Well, he's the junior coach. So some of those guys he's had for almost 4 years. He set the expectation. He was the one in charge of that. And we outside of that program did everything we could to try to help him and give him as much information as we could. I know we got a lot of input from a lot of different people. And then clearly during the race, we were trying to help him out as much as possible. And USA Cycling really dedicated a lot of resources to that. But Billy, he's the one that set the bar for those guys from the very beginning. And I kind of came back into the national team a little bit later. Like I wasn't there right from the beginning last year. It was more like mid-season. And when I came in, it was crystal clear to me that Billy had set the bar very high and that there, no matter what the outcome during the season was, they were going to the Worlds to try to win. And Billy was the one who set that bar, and he came through. And so he gets all the credit in the world for being able to manage those guys, because there's some pretty big personalities there, even at 17 and 18 years old.
They have beards.
Yeah, well, they're full-grown men. Some of them are full-grown men. Right. And, you know, they come with expectations.
Yeah.
And now some of those expectations fall on me. But ultimately, I think Billy set a very good precedent for those guys, and I think he really got them focused and organized, and they did do an insanely good race.
Yeah.
and they really set the bar very high. And then the junior women rocked up and just like
it just kept going.
Just kept going.
So you had mentioned McNulty and Garrison, right? They're both going to World Tour now. McNulty's UAE and Garrison is it Decoyna? So which is I kind of want to get your input on guys going to not traditional American style teams, right? I mean, UAE, Decoyna is not quite like going to EF or BMC probably back in the day. And you saw that with Nilsson and Sepp both going to Jumbo and then having kind of this breakout Vuelta this year. Now, Nilsson's going to go over to EF. What do you think? Is there any advantage or disadvantage to these guys going to like UAE? I'm just pulling these out in Jumbo rather than directly into Vader's system or what back then was, you know, or BMC. And I don't know if there's really any other CCC maybe kind of has that still. Do you understand what I'm saying here?
Yep. And so what I'll put it very succinctly, this is extremely important that these guys go to teams outside of the traditional pathway because like I try to always tell all of the young guys, what they do for themselves, they also do for the guys who come behind them. Now, the manager at UAE used to be the talent scout for Quickstep. So he used to be the under 23.
Who is that?
He's a Spanish guy. And he used to be the talent scout at Quickstep. And then he became the manager at UAE. So he understands, he was the one that, I can give you the long list of guys that he developed. And he was really instrumental in developing, or at least bringing to Europe, the Colombian riders. Mm. So like Gaviria, for sure, Maxine, there is no Gaviria, I tell you right now. Because he found Gaviria, brought him to Europe, like supported the Colombian teams. And then you notice like Gaviria is now over at UAE. That's not by accident.
Yeah, yeah.
And so UAE has a real focus. If you look at their roster right now, loaded. Yeah. I mean, maybe next year they don't win directly. They will. But 4 years from now, I think they're dominant.
Well, Pogacar? He'll only be, what, 24 then?
Yeah. And but they have a long list of guys. They have multiple world champions at the junior and the under 23 level. They're just extremely loaded. And then going to Quickstep, I mean, it's the, as it stands today, they're the biggest, best team in the world. To have an American there is incredibly important. It's important from Specialized side, I'm sure, to have an American there. And I think it's just really, really important for these guys to be able to go to these other teams. And, you know, JV has always done, I mean, he's the leader in bringing Americans in and supporting them and giving them a platform. And I want to make sure that JV gets his due credit because he definitely has done that, but he can't take everybody. And it's important for him to have foreign riders also. So it's really important for these guys to kind of go outside of the box and go to these other teams. The thing is, I think that these other teams are also more educated about American riders and what the requirement is to have an American rider and what the mindset is. And so it opens them up to be more flexible and have American guys in there and be more. And at least we forget, we haven't even mentioned that Matteo Jorgensen is going to Movistar.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insane. Yeah. That's absolutely insane. And it's to his credit. So what is also happening, which most people don't know, is we actually have a fleet of under 23 guys that are racing in Europe for various teams. So we have a couple guys going to French amateur teams. We have...
Is that what Jorgensen had done?
Yeah. So Matteo, he went with the AG2R under 23 team. He now is over at Movistar. And then there's a young guy, Eric Voigt, who's been racing in France for like the last 3 or 4 years. He's moved into Mateo's spot over there with AG2R. So, and then we have this young guy, Andrew Vollmer. He went to one of the oldest, most successful French Division One amateur teams, CC Etoupes. He's going to be over there next year. Hincapie, I'm not exactly sure what their model is going to be, but they're going to be in Europe most of the year. They have a couple of guys that are going to be in Europe most of the season next year.
For sure. I had heard a rumor that they were not
I don't know if it's, I've been told it's for sure.
Okay. Well, then your rumored mill is much better than mine. Trust me.
It looks like they're going to combine with another team and then have like a single team.
Okay.
So there's a couple guys there. And then there's a couple of other random guys just riding for, Riley Sheehan is riding for the Soja Sun team over in the Britannia area. So Soja Sun used to be a Pro Conti team. Okay. Now they're an under 23 team. So there's this fleet of guys that are racing over there. Again, this is extremely important.
Well, and this kind of goes to my point. Do you think it's important for these guys to, and look, back when you and I were racing, I remember Horner coming back from Europe when he was with FDJ, I think at the time, and talking to one of my teammates at the time about how he didn't know the language. This is, you know, his first go round, and he was miserable. He hated it. And he probably was putting on weight, and it's different now with cell phones. I'm sure the ability to contact, but you think it's better to kind of go off these 1-2s on these teams that maybe aren't so structured for Americans. And that's kind of my question. And cut your teeth that way so that you can maybe come back at some point. I don't know if there's a relaxation. Does it make any sense what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I think it's extremely important, but I also think the teams have learned that they need to be forthright with the riders. And so, for example, with Matteo, it wasn't when he signed that agreement, it wasn't just an agreement to be part of the team. The agreement very clearly states that he needs to be fluent in French. And so he went all in, and he was.
Yeah.
What I think these teams are learning and is that American guys, or women also, American riders, are very adept at communication, right? They know from a very early age because of school, and you have young kids, I have a 13-year-old, they know how to use computers, they use email, they contact like via text, other messaging boards. Okay. So then you take that ability to communicate as an American rider. You now have them in a foreign team. The foreign teams put the requirements on there and the riders agree to it. Like, it's all up front. There's no expectation that is not expressed. And then they end up becoming, I can tell you that the manager at AG2R told me that Matteo was his single best rider from a communication standpoint. Hmm. He emailed the most. He like communicated. There was never any secret. Everybody knew what he was doing. And because he did that, he opened the door for more Americans. So I think with Horner, I know Chris. I mean, he and I came up together.
Yeah.
And the fact is that maybe when Chris went to FDJ, like Matteo, the team was probably not completely forthright about what the expectation was. You need to know French. We only speak French here. You need to be fluent in French and not just show up and like expect us to make it happen. It's hard to say. You'd have to ask Horner. That would be based on that era. That's what I would think would have happened, is that they just didn't communicate well enough to him what the expectation was. That doesn't happen anymore. They're very clear on what the expectation is. And if the rider chooses to go there, he doesn't just take the contract to ride. He takes the contract to do all of the details. And I think American guys are really open to that, and they're really good with that if you just tell them what the expectation is.
Yeah, right. And look, back then, a team like a FDJ would maybe take one non-French guy, you know?
Yeah, right.
So you don't necessarily say your expectation because we're French, and it's understood. Okay.
But the globalization of cycling is changing things.
So now there's Ecuador and everywhere. So.
Right. And I think if you look at Movistar, I think that Movistar from 2019 to 2020... You'd have to look at the numbers, but I've heard they have something like 13 different nationalities on that team in 2020. Listen, 2 years ago, it was like all Spanish or Portuguese.
And Nairo.
Yeah. And a Colombian guy or two, but basically all Spanish based, like language based, Spanish based. Now they're opening their doors to all these other riders, which I think is great because it's one of the oldest teams in Europe. Yeah. They're clearly well organized. They clearly have a really stable financial situation, and they have great directors there and great support. So it's great that non-Spanish speaking riders can go there. At the end of the day, they're going to have to learn Spanish because that's what the team is.
Yeah.
But it's great that they even get a chance to go there. I think it's incredible.
What do you think about the Movistar racing tactics when you see them out on the road? Because sometimes it's interesting.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it works out, and then the very next day you see that it shouldn't have. There's always some weirdness. Do you think that's just due to this, you know, the Nairo or and all this Spanish Inquisition here? Inquisition. The Spanish Armada, maybe? Yeah. Or what is your take on that? Because me watching it, sometimes I'm just baffled. And then maybe I just don't know what's going on. So,
well, I mean, Colombian guys are not Spanish guys, and Spanish guys are not Colombian right. guys. And I don't know. I mean, listen, if you're going to, if I'm a writer and I'm going to Movistar and Alejandro Valverde is on the roster, I mean, he's the boss.
Yeah.
Like, the guy is like the most, one of the most successful writers in all of cycling history. So if anybody was going to go there and think, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to be the leader because I think I'm going to be the leader, or because I think this guy's getting old, I think you're not very smart.
No.
I mean, listen, Valverde is a hero in Spain, like yeah. literally a hero. No, he's not getting flicked. Like, no one is flicking that guy. So if you go there and your expectation is that you're going to supersede that guy or get him out of his leadership position, that's not going to happen. So I think if you're going to sign for that team, you have to know what the ball game is. I mean, I have no idea what their management structure is or who's really in charge or whatever. If it was me, maybe I'd do it different, but it's not me. So you have to, I think that the team is probably going to run a lot better now that they don't have these kind of dual leaders. They have to fill some, they're going to have to make up the talent loss, but in a lot of ways, if the vibe within the team is good.
Isn't Chiandri there with them now?
Yeah, Chiandri is one of their directors. And, I mean, Max speaks all the languages. Yeah. So he's probably going to be a key factor in that whole thing because he's going to be able to communicate with everybody. But I just think that maybe, I mean, listen, Quintana went to a team. He took some riders there to Arkea. Mm-hmm. He's going to create his own little environment. He's going there because he gets to be the leader. And that's what he's looking for. Maybe he was looking for that at Movistar, and it just, that's not the right team for that because Valverde is still there. So, okay, so no problem. So he goes somewhere else and they start over with something different.
What'd you think of, since we're kind of on the Spanish situation here, what'd you think of Nelson and Sup and the Jumbo team, first of all year, but especially in the Vuelta and especially those two guys?
Well, I think it's incredible. And I think that I love that team. I love that team because I know some of the directors there from my under 23 races. I think they're basically a reincarnation or a phoenix carnation of Rabobank. Yeah. Rabobank knows how to develop riders. They, back in the day, they had junior women, under 23, and elite men all on the same team. They know what they're doing from a development standpoint. We used to have a saying, my old boss, Jim Miller, and I used to have a saying, if you can make it in Holland as a rider, you can make it anywhere. It doesn't matter what type of rider you are. If you survive in Holland, you can survive anywhere. I think Jumbo has a very clear plan. Very clearly, they're only getting better because now they have like three Grand Tour riders there, winners there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think at the same time, I think that the directors there are open. They're younger directors. They're more, they have a very modern view of bike racing because I think they came up through every single type of racing, women's racing, junior, under 23, and then into the elite. And I think they have very open minds about how racing can happen. And so you look at the Vuelta and you see that Sepp is not only riding for the team, but then he gets his opportunity to go win a stage, and it all ends up kind of working out because these Grand Tours are getting to this point where they're just getting nuts from a course standpoint. I think Nielsen, the coin could have very easily been on the other foot, and like Nielsen could have had that opportunity. I think that's a great thing about the way racing is going, is that these teams, if they're very well organized and they have a very modern view of racing and training and organization, you're going to get some really incredible opportunities there, even if you have very definitive leaders that are there to win big races, you know?
Yeah. So Nielsen, what do you think of him going forward? Now he goes to EF. He obviously his first year was a little rough. I think he was injured or sick or something. What do you think his prospects are? It's probably not everybody. It's not that you get a ride for a Grand Tour champion. I mean, he's got that under his belt. His first attempt, he gets to have a Grand Tour champion. That's pretty significant. But what do you think his prospects are going forward?
Well, I think he gets to go with EF. He's going to get probably some more freedom there. The way Jonathan and JV has the team organized, they don't necessarily have like a definitive Grand Tour winner. I mean, they have Rigo. Rigo is their Grand Tour focused, I think, and they have some young guys coming. But at the end of the day, you know, I think he has a younger team, very hungry, motivated guys, and you know, I think they're very modern thinking team. Like he and Wigelius think. I mean, very clearly, Vodders is very modern thinking in everything that he does. And so I think he probably has a very clear view of where he wants the team to go and what he wants the team to do. And the younger guys are going to get a ton of opportunities to go out and race and get results. And I think that creates a good vibe within the team. And it seems to me that even some of these guys, we'll call them middle-aged guys, like Lawson is like a middle-aged guy, not really, but in racing sense he is. You know, even a guy like Lawson can create his own goals in his mind and probably go to the team and say, hey, listen, I'm really interested in doing this. Is it okay if I pursue these goals within the team structure? And, you know, it works for them because it's results for the team and, you know, how's racing gravel and doing these things. It all gets results for the team. So those are important things. And I think you have an organization in EF that is very forward thinking and they understand they have to reach a lot of eyeballs. And, you know, racing, pro bike racing in some aspects is a very small group of viewership or participation. Right. So doing things like gravel or being on bigger stages like Olympic Games or World Championships is really important for all of these teams. And, you know, some of these teams are just, like I said, they're just a little more forward-thinking than other teams. And I think that these forward-thinking teams are really going to end up super successful at the end of the day.
You had mentioned, and don't let me forget, just talk about the Olympics. But while we're still kind of on the Grand Tour stuff, you said the routes are going crazy. So they announced the Giro route, they announced the Tour route, and it almost looks like the Tour is trying to be the Vuelta. And now the Giro is almost trying to be the Tour because the long stage. Have you taken a good look at either one of those? And what's your take on kind of what they're doing?
Yeah, I think they're all fighting to get rider participation because they all want the best riders to be there.
Yeah.
So these Grand Tour teams, there's only so many guys, and a lot of guys, you know, you can't really do three Grand Tours in a year. So if some guys do two, that's like a big ask. So how are you going to make it dynamic? How are you going to get viewership? You know, I mean, they have to do some of these different things and they have to, again, they have to think outside the box. And I think it's like an arms race right now.
Yeah.
You know, and at some point it's going to get a little bit, well, I don't know. I would assume at some point it might get a little bit out of control. Someone's going to have to be like, okay, well, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe you don't do 280K and then have like 6 mile passes or something like that. You know, I mean, you have to give the rider some aspect of recovery, but you know, if you're going to make the stages short, I mean, we've all seen it. The shorter the stages are, a lot of times the more dynamic they are. And that makes for exciting bike racing. And yeah, maybe the stage is not 5 hours long, so there's not 5 hours of viewership, but if you capture 25% more viewership because they know that the finish is going to be a little bit nutso, then maybe it's worth it.
Like the grid start. That got me tuned into the beginning.
I don't know about the grid start. Oh, but
maybe not.
But some of these things that, you know, like even just the Tour, like riding cobbles is really interesting. I know some guys really, really don't like it. I know when we did it at BMC and Cadell was part of that, Cadell was like salivating. Because he knew. He's like, I can do this. Like, this is, if you compare me to all of the other Grand Tour GC guys, I'm the best.
Got an advantage,
I've got an advantage. So, of course, I'm going to leverage it. Like, those guys get leverage in the high, high mountains where maybe Cadell was not the best of the best of the best. So, he's going to leverage where he's good. And I think it just opens up. It opens up to maybe some really, I mean, listen, Carapaz winning a Grand Tour, nobody had that on their radar.
No.
So that's great. Great for his country. Great for him. Great for his team. you know, great for viewership, because now you're like, you've got a guy in there that is, was not chosen by anybody, and he ends up winning. And then you, and then something crazy happens, like you go to World Championships and the early breakaway has two Grand Tour winners in the early break, and it's like, holy macro, like, this is incredible. You never see this.
Yeah, yeah.
So racing is really changing. And I mean, from top to bottom, it's changing. And I think it makes it more exciting.
Well, you know, the tour this year, no stage over 200, no time trials until the very end up the Planche de Belfi. That's just, it's the Vuelta is what it is. So, which will be fun. Okay. Let's go back to what we were talking about with the Olympics. You're gearing up for that. And you made a really interesting point, which has been in place for a while. Your placement at Worlds for the time trial dictates how many slots you basically get for the Olympics. And I remember a few years ago when Taylor Finney was he the right pick or not to be this? I had said at the time, I had a little blog post about it, that he deserved it. One, he was the only one of the riders that showed up at Worlds that year. And he got the top 15 or 10. I think it was 15, somewhere in there. He and Talansky were like 15, 16, something like that, 14, 15. So it, and you didn't get, I think, the extra slot, but he at least showed up, gave that effort. He deserves. Is there a problem with some of these big riders not participating at Worlds and trying to get the slot for the Americans at the Olympics? Or is this a bad way to tie those two in? And how do you motivate a TJ, an example, to show up at Worlds to maybe be able to participate at the Olympics?
Well, I think that from the first Olympics I did in 2012 to the one that's approaching, and we'll see how 2020 all plays out. But ultimately, I think what is happening is that the riders are, so we had a period where it was hard to get riders to kind of motivate for some of these things like Worlds and things like that. But I think that has changed now, especially at the elite ranks. I think the riders realize that it's a great opportunity to go and maybe, you know, solidify their place within their team or be able to solidify a spot at an Olympic Games.
Do the teams take a high reading of your results at Worlds? I mean, I imagine they would, right?
Yeah,
I mean, even though you're in your country outfit, but.
Yeah, No. I mean, they definitely pay attention. They definitely pay attention, and I think the Olympic Games, because it falls in the middle, like in the middle-ish part of the season, or the last third, let's call it. It's a little difficult because guys are like off of their, you know, they can't do other races after because they're going to the Olympic Games, and there's a lot of buildup before and travel and kind of locked down, and you got to be there a certain time ahead, and then you do it, and
it's right after the tour, right?
Yeah, so right after the tour, so there it makes it really difficult. But I think the riders are in this position where, you know, they're becoming more and more motivated to participate in those events, and they're asking their teams if they can have a little more leeway when it comes to being selected for those events, especially if they're in like the long pull, the mm-hmm. long pool of riders. And so, you know, I think these races are becoming more and more important. And the way that the Pro Tour, World Tour points rankings are coming into play, the riders are finding it more and more important, not only for them, but for their standing within their teams and their teams. And so it's easier, in my opinion, it's easier now to get riders to want to be at World Championships and be at Olympic Games than it was maybe 10 years ago. It wasn't as easy. It was more difficult to try to get guys to motivate to get through the end of October. But part of that might be is that the racing season used to end with Worlds.
Yeah.
Now Worlds is like the middle of the season. It's an over-exaggeration, but it's literally like there's a whole bunch of racing that happens right after it. That's important racing from a World Tour point standpoint. So now riders are not getting to Worlds and then it's like, okay, that's it. They're getting to Worlds and then they're like, okay, this is just another race. It's an important race. It's another important race, but it's just another important race in a series of races that I need to do. And the Grand Tours are becoming more important. Like the Vuelta, in my opinion, now is, I actually think the Vuelta is closing the gap on popularity to the Giro and the Tour. So where before it was maybe not as popular, I think now with the way that they've organized it, exciting finishes, it's becoming more important. And riders are seeing it as on a level where if they get a result at the Vuelta stage win, it really holds a lot of water with their teams. And the teams put a lot of effort into preparing for it, just like the Tour and the Giro. Not the same teams, but teams. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's a great opportunity across the board. And I think Worlds is gaining strength from its from where it falls in the new calendar that has been created over the last 5 years.
So what is the structure for Americans to make Olympic teams? Have you drawn that out? I know it's changed since my interest way back when through now about how you qualify. What is the, do you know about that? Has that been released?
Yeah. So it's a, for all intents and purposes, I believe Jeff Pierce has finalized that. It should be finalized. It should be posted on the USA Cycling website. There was always links. Again, everybody wants to be forthright here, and they're really adamant about making it crystal clear on what you need to do. Some riders are in better position than other riders. I don't think that there's any riders that are not in the long pool that are going to come. Like, no one's going to come from nowhere, because there's World Tour ranking points and position and results within races. And because the selection process is somewhat forethought, in other words, you're looking at results in the year prior to make those selections or to be able to get yourself in the log pool to be selected for those spots. There is no secret about that. And so, you know, I think you're not going to have somebody just come from nowhere and not qualify. So in the old, like in our days where they had Olympic trials, you could have a guy like Bob Mianski who would win the race and then he would go to the Olympics, right? Yeah. Or the selection was literally made like when they had the 5-race series. You know, Greg Randolph was literally picked.
I was just going to say, Greg Randolph. Because I grew up racing with him out in the Northwest.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he's selected for some odd reason. And then, because I think Frankie was the only one that made the actual, all the races and qualified that way. Is that?
Yeah. So I think that year, because I went for it that year. I think Lance qualified off of his who he was and what he was doing. Yeah. Then Frankie qualified off of the point series from the Olympic trials, and then Randolph was the coach's selection. We'll call it the Lance's selection.
Yeah.
Because there were other guys like Horner should have been in the running. Actually, truthfully, Freddy Rodriguez should have been in the running that year. Steve Haig should have been in the running that year. So it was like, you know, there was a selection where the point of the matter is that the selection was made literally like weeks before the Olympics. Yeah, the selection might be made again in the same time frame, but it's not, you're not going to get somebody selected that isn't keenly aware that they might be selected or be really, really trying to get selected. Like, the riders that are going to get selected are going to really be fighting to get selected.
How many can they take for the road?
So for the men, for the road and the TT, we get two guys total, two total. That's not a lot, but it's what we get.
Yeah. What's the most a team can have? Do you know?
The most the men's team could have, I believe, is 5. I'd have to double check that. I haven't looked at it for a couple of weeks. I believe it's 5. The women are maxed out. So I had the, and I'm going to say this, I had the distinct pleasure, and it super was a pleasure for me, to go and lead the women's world team at the Ladies Tour of Belgium this year. Mm-hmm. It was right before we went to Worlds, or like a couple, like 10 days before. And it was an incredible experience for me. It was the first women's race that I'd ever done. And I'm sure the ladies that I was there with are going to laugh, but I was super nervous going in, like really, really nervous, because I'd never done a women's race before and I didn't know what to expect. And we had, you know, we had Corinne and Ruth and Katie Hall, and we were stacked. And so I knew we were stacked. And so I was less nervous just because I knew we had really good riders. But it was a great experience for me. And those ladies were at the time, it wasn't we, it was them. They were fighting with the Germans for the overall points to try to get seeded as we go into the Olympic year. And it was like between the Germans and the Americans, and I think the Italians were floating in there. It was like a three race battle for fourth, fifth, and sixth. And so every single point that we were going to get or that they were trying to get was super important. And the week before we did that, you know, the Germans had a really good race. And then we went to this and we won three or four stages and had, you know, had a really good race. And the ladies were really on point, except for one. We made one little mistake. But outside of that, they were really on point. And at the end of the year, I think they ended up fourth at the end of 2019. And so that, you know, that assured that they were at maximum numbers at the Olympics, and that's really important, right? Oh, yeah. Because we have really good lady riders. We always have. But these ladies they're not only really good riders, but they're super tight on a personal level. And I think what I saw was a lot of support. I saw a lot of internal support from them for each other. And then they have Ina Tunberg, who is going to be their director there. And okay. I mean, come on.
Right.
At the end of the day, Ina's not only one of the best women's directors, I'd put her up against Johan Berniel any day of the week. Like, any day of the week. She's literally one of the best directors in the world. So, I mean, they've got... I mean, for them, it's they're really going in with a very high level of expectation.
Where is the Olympics?
Tokyo.
Okay, that's right. And have you seen the course profile? What kind of rider does it...
It's very hilly.
Okay.
It's very hilly.
So... Look, and that's got to be difficult because is there any modification or does the coach, I haven't looked at what Pierce put online yet. Is there any way to, let's say two big sprinters make the qualify. Is there any way to say, this is maybe worth our time to take two sprinters?
I can't answer that right now. I don't know. I mean, there's a selection process and I think if you're fulfilling the selection process, you're going to end up with two riders who are qualified on the men's side and five on the women's right. side that are qualified.
Yeah. And I mean, there's not much you can do. You got to somewhat have a fair platform of how to select them, but then.
Like, yeah. And the men are in the same boat. Like there's a lot of really good time trialists. I mean, I could go down the list and give you 10 guys that are qualified to go. Like, I mean, like legitimately qualified to go. You can start with Garrison and McNulty. You can say Haga and Lawson. You can include, I mean, there's just, I mean, okay, TJ, there's a whole list of guys that are super qualified to go. Bookwalter, I mean, like,
right.
You know, like 10 or 12 guys, and it's going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard to select.
And it may be really good. Look, I'll have to look and see which races, especially for the time trial, qualify, because that you may see some Americans really taking shots at these time trials throughout the year if that's what qualifies them for the time trial slots. So,
well, there's a whole series of things. I mean, it's not just TTs, but TTs are going to matter for the TT. But yeah, I mean, they're going to be fighting for results all year, but it's what it is. It goes hand in hand with what the trade teams are looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
The new World Tour structure points, they go very deep every single race, and it's really, I mean, it's no longer like, okay, I'm out of the top 10, so I'm going to cruise. Like, this is what is making racing more and more dynamic, is that now, like, guys sprinting for 30th place, like, legitimately might make a difference for them, for their team, for their country. It all is worth, I mean, that's what the UCI is trying to do. They're trying to make it work, or at least that's how I see it. They're trying to make it work all hand in hand. And so it's going to be really important for guys to fight, like, all year, like every single year. But even now, I mean, with the point structure, it just makes it really, really important for guys to fight all year, and no one has the pole position. And, you know, if guys catch lightning in a bottle and they get a really, really good run and start racking up a bunch of points and getting a bunch of results, I mean, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. But what I know is that there's like 12 guys or 13 or 14 guys out there that all are really motivated to go, and they're going to do what they can, and they just have to fulfill the requirements. And then there's a committee that decides. That's what makes America maybe slightly different. There's a committee that kind of makes the selection process, and the committee will make the selection, and that'll be that.
Well, that's excitement to look for. Hey, yeah. Before we finish up here, some few quick items. Rohan Dennis. anything you want to say about him and his future? Or, you know, look, obviously world time trial champion, but had a little issue at the Tour de France. Any comments you have on that? Did you work with him? I mean, you were with
BMC. He came after me, but I actually am friendly with Rowan, and he's a, you know what? He's a big game rider. Like I used to say this about Finney. Finney was a big game rider, like big game, big ride. Rowan very clearly is a big game rider. Yeah. And, you know, I think he needs to be on a team that suits his personality. But that's no different than any other sport. Right. You know, you get some guys that are on a team and the personality just doesn't work. If it was me or if like I was an advisor, would I maybe advise him to do it different? Yeah, if it was me, I would have. But, you know, he's a grown man. He made his own decisions. But at the end of the day, he shows up at Worlds and he wins convincingly. And he's right back in the conversation of one of the best riders in the world, a guy that can win a multi-day stage race, the single best TT guy right now across the board. And he comes in with no racing and no, you know, only doing it off of training. I know his coaches very well, and they got him ready, and he showed up and got it done.
Is that a little more frustrating, though, that he almost threw away a Tour de France stage win? I mean,
as a guy that would never win a stage of the Tour de France, yes, but I'm not him. You know, I mean, I don't have that talent, never did, never will. And so he, like I said, I mean, he's an adult, man. He made his adult decisions. Yeah. And maybe at the time, I don't know. I mean, you would have to ask him, but at the time he probably thought that he could do it. As you're looking at it, you're like, oh man, that's a huge mountain to climb to win Worlds with no racing. And then he does it. And you're like,
convincingly.
Yeah. And then you're like, man, you are the man. Yeah. Like, you really are the man. That's incredible.
Any idea where he's going? I have not heard.
Okay. I haven't heard anything. His Instagram has been great. He's been posting the jersey a lot, which is awesome.
As you would.
You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe just.
Time trials?
Yeah. Maybe he just rocks up to a bunch of TTs with the world championship jersey. I mean, it's great. It's like, again, it's a personality. It's a story. And for good or for bad, we need this in cycling.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I totally agree with that. And, you know, the Peter Sagan is really interesting. And then you have, I don't know how do I morph this into, a bunch of these races are moving to like, you know, the UAE, or the Saudi Arabia and all the Middle East. And it doesn't look like there's much interest from the fan perspective. Any idea why these races are going there? I mean, is it just money? And why do those Saudi kings or whomever, why do they want the bike racing there? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. But I mean, I think I've always been a big believer that cycling kind of falls into this in its own kind of very low, like small way. It falls into this kind of like, you like race car thing, like, you know, like car personality, car atmosphere, where, you know, you have these really fast cars and you can spend a bunch of money on cars, have a really fast car with a lot of carbon fiber and a super sleek body, and you get in it, doesn't matter who you are, if you spend the money, you can have it, you drive around. Bikes are the same way. Like you can spend $20,000 on a bike and have like the most incredible, most beautiful ride in the world that you can be really proud of and like show off, and it's like your Sunday driver or whatever. And cycling to me, it kind of falls into this realm of like this race car thing where, you know, there's a lot, F1 does a lot in the Middle East. They have a lot of support down there or over there. And I think cycling's the same way. Right now it's just got a lot of support, and those areas are putting a lot of money into it. And I mean, I guess if you're not going to, I guess in some ways, if you live in a place and there's not a lot of roads and there's not a lot of red tape to make sure races happen, races are going to happen.
Yeah,
but if you throw up a bunch of roadblocks and you make it really difficult to have a bike race, it's probably not going to happen.
Well, I mean, you know? California, in a sense. I mean, I don't know about, well, it's probably difficult. You know, anytime when we put on a race, just hire the police to close down the, you know, your crit course, you know, you're paying them overtime. It's really expensive. I could not imagine touring the state of California and the cost it does to do that. It's got to be outlandish.
Yeah. And then you go to a place like Colorado where they don't even have road racing anymore because they can't get the roads. It's like, well, there's these places that are willing to like open the doors and let you do, let you have plenty of racing whenever you want it. Yeah. And it's like, well, we need races. So that's where we're going.
And then that's where we're headed. So
that's where we're headed.
One last thing, and then we'll let you head out of here. Look, we're here in Sacramento area. We have the River Ride. We have Coffee Republic and all those kind of things. I just want to get, maybe this is a learning time for someone. Paceline. People have trouble on Paceline. Give me your breakdown of how this should happen. When you take the wheel, or you take the front and you pull off, are you supposed to speed up? Are you supposed to slow down? Give some newbie out there, or even some oldie that's been doing this a lot, doing it wrong. What is your take on how that proper Paceline etiquette is supposed to be?
It's a difficult skill to learn, but I think the number one thing is that, you know, generally in a Paceline, you're not trying to, it's not about how strong you are, it's about how smooth you are. That's what makes a Paceline go fast. The speed is generated through the smoothness of the Paceline, not necessarily the strength of the riders. Might be a little bit different if we're talking like an echelon type thing, but if we're just talking straight Paceline, and cycling, one of my kind of pillars of cycling, like personally, is that cycling is the ultimate give and take sport. If you break the sport down from very top to very bottom, there's very rarely a scenario where it's not a give and take situation. So a breakaway, like one guy's riding the front, one guy's sitting on, then the coin flips. So it's a giver and a taker. Paceline is the same way. Like, you know, you're doing it in a much quicker fashion, but it's giving and taking. Like someone is rolling through and doing the work. That's the giver. The person falling back or on the wheel is the taker. And you just have to remember that it's you're not racing the guys in the pace line. You're actually working together. So the pace has to be at such a level and dictated by such a pace that everyone can continue to move. And so one of the key examples, I think, of when a Paceline becomes more about strength and less about smoothness is, you know, if you have a situation, let's say you have 10 guys rolling through, and then all of a sudden there's two guys rolling through now and like eight guys have disappeared, probably that's going to be a key indicator that the pace was too high. And so again, this becomes that scenario where maybe a little less is a little more.
Right.
So slowing down a little bit, allowing everybody to get the recovery they need so that they can start rolling through again. In the short term, you're going slower. In the long term, you're going to go faster. And I tell guys all the time, it's not, you know, Paceline is not about how hard or how, you know, fast you are going. It's about how smooth it is. And respecting that small group of individuals that you're with at that moment, right? Because cycling, it changes all the time. First you're in a pack and then you're in a group and then, you know, your teammates with a guy in a breakaway and then you're racing against him to get the result. So it's very fluid and dynamic like that. But ultimately, if you're riding a Paceline at that particular moment, these guys are your teammates, even though they may have a different jersey on, you have to treat them as such. And maybe sometimes a little less is a little more.
Yeah, don't drop your teammates.
Don't drop your teammates. And it's not a strength show. The strength will dictate itself. Yeah. I mean, cycling is one of those sports. Very, very rarely does someone succeed because they used brute force to make it happen. It's a lot of times it's just a lot of like, it's just a lot of thinking and a lot of analyzing and a lot of nuance that, again, you know, I think for newer riders, even older riders, I think the idea of a little bit less, like in other words, if you're going, you know, you're pulling, we'll use wattage here. If you're pulling at 300 watts, like if someone says, hey, you're pulling too hard, that doesn't immediately mean you go to 100 watts.
Yeah, no.
There's 200 watts in between there that you're free to go to that will make the difference. And sometimes the difference between 300 and 280 is the difference between a guy being able to recover and a guy not. And so it doesn't have to be an all or nothing prospect. Nuance is really important. And so, you know, just taking a little bit off, just going a little bit easier can make the difference for a guy or a woman to be able to get enough recovery to continue to contribute to the outcome of whatever goal you're trying to achieve.
Right. And you talk about, and we'll finish up here, but we talk about brute force. You know, I've seen this with a young rider that's just phenomenal. They use that brute force, easily win. Well, as they move up in the categories, now that doesn't come to fruition as much, and they need to learn the team tactics and stuff. So when you have those young riders that are smart, maybe they're not as strong, I tend to see that they adapt better as they move up in the categories a little bit.
So. Yeah, you just got to teach them. There's nuance. So
use your head.
Use your head and like not just use your head, but like really like use your eyes and really think about what's happening within the group. So if you look next to you and you see a guy is just absolutely dying, and they just are like, I can't pull because I'm just over the top. It's like, okay, well, why don't just back it off a little bit and see if 2 minutes from now they can now pull because you went a little bit easier. You know, I don't think anybody is overly malicious in this sport. Like they just don't want to pull or whatever. Right. But I think people get, they just can't. Like they get to a point where they're just over the top and they need to recover. And I think everybody just has to understand that, you know, we're at some point in the year, everybody's in the same boat. Like at some point in the year, you're not as fit as the guys next to you.
That's the boat I'm in right now.
Yeah.
Well, it's a rough boat.
It's a rough boat, but you know,
it's got a lot of holes. It's sinking.
But guess what? There's a solution.
Yes. You're back. Last time you were in here, you had a back problem. I know you've been obviously riding now. At least I see you out there. So yeah. Health good? Going well?
Yeah. Health was good up until about a week. I've been having some issues, but yeah, health was good. And I will say it's, oh man, it's really hard to get old. And yes. I'm coming to this, I'm facing the music right now. And yeah, it's disappointing and disheartening at times. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, it looks like my back is never going to be what it was and that it's going to be a constant struggle for me. And I have come to grips with it and I've embraced it. And it just is what it is. And we all have weaknesses. And I think for me on a personal level, the hardest thing is that I have been extremely fortunate in my life. I grew up ski racing. I moved into cycling. My body never gave out on me, never. And like basically in 48 years. Yeah. And it finally did. And it's really hard to come to grips with that. But it is my new reality, and it's humbled me a lot. It's led me to, I've gone through this kind of self-discovery phase over the last year and a half, and it just has been another thing that I've just had to come to grips with and kind of shake its hand and just understand that that's reality. But for people who, I mean, this is for anybody out there that struggles with physical problems, whether it's knee or neck or back or whatever it is, you know what? It's at some point you just got to, it's like, you know, you got to kind of embrace the suck in it and find a way around it.
Yeah.
And you may never be what you were before, but it's okay. You can find pleasure in where you're at right at that moment. And that's what I've been doing. And so it's been really like, I've stopped riding my mountain bike because my back just doesn't like it. And I may not be able to go back, and I can ride gravel and that's fine as long as it's not too overly technical, but you know, my back just can't really handle getting super gnarly anymore. And it just is what it is. And so I'm good with it. I just move on to other things and kind of embrace what I'm having fun doing and just stay in that lane.
Yeah. Well, how old are you? 48?
No, I'll be 50 in January.
50 in January. Oh, I'm a young 48 compared to you then. So hopefully my back will be okay. Hey, I really appreciate you once again coming in. We'll keep doing this all year long. I'm sure you're going to race this year. Is that right? We're going to see.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. I mean, the travel schedule can be a little difficult at times, but you know, when I'm there, I'll be there. When I'm not there, I'll be back at some point.
Good. So we'll see you on the road. We'll look for your podcast too. Yep. I'll link that up so everyone can check that out. Once again, thank you everybody and thank you, Mike, for coming in. Between Two Wheels podcast. Check us out everywhere. We're on YouTube, Facebook, Between Two. What do you have any social media you want to push real quick?
I just have my personal social media right now, which is I'm usually go all my taglines are at Mikey Havoc for for those who know that
story. We'll link you up here on the show.
We'll get in that story someday. But anyway, yeah, Mikey Havoc is usually where I'm at. I always appreciate being a guest here. This is a very important podcast from Northern California.
Yeah, did you hear that?
It really is. It's super important, and I think it builds a sense of community.
Yeah.
I really, really, I mean, I don't know. I'm probably like you. The older I get, the more I love it here, and this is my home. I've always embraced it here, but I'm here all the time now, and I love Sacramento. I only want the best for the people in this town and the people in our riding community, and I hope everybody is just... You know, I've really tried to make myself much more available to people just for anything. And I always try to help people out. And I just really feel part of this community, and it's really important to me. And this, things like this are really important to the community.
Yeah, so. Well, you know, this community, we're all about community here, Mike.
So. Yeah, cool.
Thanks again. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and check us out everywhere you can find this podcast. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ed.